From WIPR, I'm Sheila Cast, and this is Maryland Morning. Howard County Executive Alan Kittleman tells us why the county is cracking down on human trafficking. We talk to a service provider about what victims need and a police detective about new state laws. Then Tom Hall talks to New York Times reporter Scott Shane, who's discussing his new book, Objective Troy, at the Pratt Library tonight. It's the story of drone strikes that killed American imam-turned-terrorist Anwar al-Awlaki. Plus, Tom talks to Michael Blum about the world premiere musical he's directing at the Spotlighters Theater, written by the Victorian dramatist W.S. Gilbert of Gilbert and Sullivan fame. And theater critic J. Wynn Russick reviews J.B. Priestley's psychological thriller, An Inspector Calls, which opens Everyman Theater's 25th season. First News.
I'm producer Jonna McCone. To catch the news, you'll need to listen to us live on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday mornings at 9 o'clock on 88.1 FM in Baltimore and Frederick, 106.9 in Ocean City, and streaming online at wypr.org/listen. Now, on with the show.
Good morning. It's Maryland Morning on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. For the first 5 years he worked on the Howard County Police Force, Detective Josh Mouton said he wasn't really looking for situations in which women had been forced into the sex trade against their will, with no share of the money they were bringing in.
There wasn't anything in place. Human trafficking, it's still somewhat new to law enforcement. I've been doing this for 3 years, this position, and before me, there wasn't even a human trafficking case in Howard County.
We caught up with Mouton Friday evening. He pulled to the shoulder of Route 175 in Columbia to talk on the phone about some of the clues that help him spot a trafficking situation.
The hardest part is interviewing these victims because they very rarely self-identify, very rarely. They either don't realize they're a victim or they're getting, you know, they're plied with drugs to keep them providing services. So they need this drug, they need this high, or more often than not, it's a love, domestic type of situation.
Detective Mouton said he has tougher state laws to work with now.
About 3 years ago, it used to just be pandering, which is a catch-all, gray kind of prostitution thing. It was really ridiculous. But they enacted these new laws, trafficking, whether it's for compensation or if someone uses force or fraud, coercion. There's different ways, and they're great. The laws are great now. They really give somebody like me the teeth to properly charge someone who's using, you know, this girl, but trying to act like they're not doing anything at all. It's nice. I have a lot of options to charge properly.
In particular, Mouton says a 2013 law that lets the state seize assets of someone convicted of trafficking could have a big impact.
There's needs for victims, and there's needs for training for law enforcement. And, you know, obviously it's always, you know, it comes back to, well, how can we pay for this? And so these assets that I was seizing, typically money, but sometimes cars and some jewelry, it was just kind of going into a general fund. And, you know, I think they found that there's a great need for that money to be used properly and certainly for victim services and you know, there's all sorts of training for not just vice detectives, but the patrol officers who are usually coming into contact first with these victims.
Joining us now by phone to discuss why and how Howard County is putting new emphasis on human trafficking is County Executive Alan Kittleman, who finalized the order to create a fund to provide services for human trafficking victims. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Sheila. How are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
I'm doing very good, thank you. Thanks for having me.
Sure. And also joining us by phone is Deneen Yates. She's Executive Director of Safe House of Hope, a nonprofit based in Howard County that provides education, training, and support to victims of human trafficking. She's also Deputy Chair of the state's Human Trafficking Task Force. Deneen Yates, welcome.
Good morning. How are you doing?
So, Deneen, very briefly, how much of a problem is human trafficking in Howard County?
I think it's a lot bigger than we think it is, and the more resources we put to looking for victims and looking for cases, the more we see that we need more resources. So there's no research to really show how large it is in any area, but there's many hotels, and there's a lot of girls online, so it's a big issue.
County Executive Kettleman, you're less than a year into this job, and I'm sure you've got lots of issues claiming your attention. Why the focus on human trafficking among your top issues?
Well, I certainly have learned a lot about it in the last 10 months as I got into office. But prior to my coming into office, the Howard County Council had put together a human trafficking task force that provided a report at the end of last year. And part of that report included this fund that you heard the officer talk about. And that's one of the reasons we put that together, because they suggested that we have a forfeiture fund for human trafficking that we can put money toward victim assistance as well as training for law enforcement officers. So that was something I could do by executive order, so I did that with the understanding that we'll put it actually in the budget next year and have a separate fund. Right now it's kind of there because I put it there, but I want to make sure it's actually part of the budget and stays there in the future.
And it's estimated the first year will be about $25,000.
That's what we estimate. Right now, as you know, we have the one police officer, but we're also hiring a second police officer. So we'll have two full-time police officers focusing strictly on human trafficking, which certainly, as you could hear from the officer earlier, we need that. We need to make sure we have the resources there helping these individuals. And so because of that, we think it'll probably get about $25,000. We're not sure how much it would be, but of course, half of that would go to help survivors and victims, and half would go to law enforcement.
And Deneen Yates, I gather there's not been a decision yet about which the half that goes to victim services is envisioned to go to one nonprofit or one group that's helping victims.
I really have no idea how they'll split it up. I mean, I know in the Maryland we apply for it as we have victim needs. Victims need housing right away, and they need clothing when they leave. They have nothing. They're not allowed to leave their trafficker with anything but the clothes on their back.
So, yes, Sheila, I say we haven't made that decision either. We certainly are going to be looking at different organizations. My hope is that it goes to a nonprofit, something similar to Safe House of Hope, but just to make sure that it provides, like she says, the housing, also counseling and other support services. So we'll be looking at that as the fund grows.
That's Howard County Executive Alan Kettleman here on Maryland Morning 88.1. He last month set up a fund to channel seized assets of convicted traffickers into enforcement and into services. Also with us is Deneen Yates, Executive Director of Safe House of Hope, a nonprofit that provides services to victims of human trafficking. Deneen Yates, and you mentioned this in passing too. One of the things that Detective Mouton told us is that in the last 5 years or so, human trafficking has completely moved online. All the activity, he said, is marketed on the internet, not on the street. Does I gather that matches what you've seen too?
Yeah, I would say 80% to 90%. I mean, every day a woman has a quota for her trafficker, and if she doesn't make her quota online, then literally she could be outside of the hotel from 9 to 10 to make the room fee for the day. So other than short stints on the street, almost all is online.
Well, I'm trying to get a sense, and I know your nonprofit is based in Howard County. You serve on a statewide task force. How can a county have much impact on something that is online and in many places?
Well, we actually do online outreach. So we run an ad in the same place that clients put their ads so that they can see our ad is there. We have a drop-in center that women can come to in Howard County on Thursdays. And you'd be surprised by texting and calling people how many people just want an option to get out.
So you find that there are some victims. I mean, one of the things that you heard Detective Mouton told us was that victims often don't self-identify as victims.
They never self-identify, and it takes between 3 months and 2 years to get someone to actually realize that they were a victim.
But then they often are eager to get out.
Well, you don't have to see yourself as a victim to see that you're in a place you don't want to be in.
Gotcha. Well, County Executive Kettleman, I'm just trying to get a sense of whether you worry that if Howard County does a terrific job of enforcement, the problem just moves. someplace up or down 95.
Well, I want to make sure we do the best enforcement we can, but I'm sure we'll be working with the state police and our other local jurisdictions to help whatever we can. We're also looking at putting in local legislation. Right now in Maryland, it's my understanding that Charles County, and I think it's Washington County, have local bills that govern the regulation of massage establishments, and that's certainly where a lot of this occurs. And so we'll be asking the Howard County delegation to put in local legislation this year that would allow us to have some regulation authority and licensing authority, just to give more tools to our police officers to be able to regulate and to make sure that we can do the best we can to try to stop this.
Do you find, as you talk, when you talk to officials in other counties, that this is a high priority elsewhere too?
I do. I mean, I haven't had that much discussion with other folks about this. I have a little bit, but certainly all the local county executives that I've talked to and county council members want to make sure they can stop this. And, you know, I tell you, a lot of people think in Howard County, if it's happening in Howard County, gosh, it must be happening everywhere, because people think Howard County is a special place, and it really is. I've lived here all my life, but we have issues too, and we have to make sure we address those. And so regardless of what anyone else is doing, Howard County is going to make sure that we take leadership to help it not happen in Howard County. And the stories I've heard, Sheila, just break your heart. I'm a father of two daughters, and to hear about these middle school age young women being coerced into this, and you know, Deneen's exactly right. They think they're doing it because they love this person or whatever, and it's just so sad to see what happens. And so, you know, I don't think we can put enough resources. We'll put as much as we possibly can, but there can never be enough resources to make sure we stop this.
Deneen, we have just a minute or so left, so it's probably not fair to ask you such a big question, but what is your priority for what else needs to be done?
We need to do the preventative work in schools, in middle schools and high schools, with parents and children, and we need to address the demand issue. This is a demand-supply issue. So it's $33 billion worldwide, 12.9 million in the U.S. spent on sex for money. So, you know, if we could also address the demand issue and do reverse things and other stop, you know, $1,500 for the first time offense, I think we could get somewhere.
I appreciate you both talking to us about it. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you so much, Sheila.
Alan Kittleman is the Howard County executive who set in stone the creation of the Human Trafficking Fund. Deneen Yates is executive director of Safe House of Hope, a nonprofit that works with victims of human trafficking. She's also deputy chair of the state's Human Trafficking Task Force. We've got more information on our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning, including more of our conversation with Detective Josh Mouton. I'm Sheila Cast, ahead on Maryland Morning, looking into the power and risks of drone strikes. Stay with us on 88.1.
Is there an issue you'd like to see us cover? Let us know. You can email us at mdmorning@wypr.org or leave us a voicemail at 410-881-3162. Visit us on the web to leave comments or to hear previous episodes. Again, that's wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Now, on with the show.
On 88.1, it's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. My guest today is Scott Shane. He's a former reporter for the Baltimore Sun who has covered national security for the New York Times since 2004. His latest book is about how a Muslim cleric named Anwar al-Awlaki evolved from a moderate imam who denounced the 9/11 attacks into one of the most celebrated and influential figures in the cause of violent jihad. In 2009, he helped plan an unsuccessful attack on a plane headed for Detroit. He was influential to the perpetrators of attacks at Fort Hood in Texas and at the Boston Marathon. By 2010, the U.S. government considered only Osama bin Laden to be more powerful and influential than al-Awlaki, as a fomenter of violence against Americans. The effort to locate and kill him was dubbed Objective Troy. Scott Shane's fascinating and assiduously reported book tells the story of that operation and elucidates the complexities and geopolitical ramifications of that mission to American foreign policy in the Middle East and to the essential moral fundaments of our democracy. It is a great read. It's called Objective Troy, A Terrorist, A President, and the Rise of the Drone. Scott Shane will be speaking about the book tonight at the Pratt Library. Today he joins me in the studio. It's good to see you.
Great to see you, Tom. Thanks for having me on.
So, spoiler alert here for everybody. Anwar al-Awlaki dies in a drone strike in September of 2011. Drones had been used before that mission. They are used to this day. There's tons of video evidence that shows al-Awlaki encouraging Muslims to kill Americans. He collaborated with the so-called underwear bomber on Christmas Day who tried to blow up a plane, Umar Abdulmutallab. But among constitutional scholars, it's simply not a cut-and-dry case that this guy should have been killed. He seems like a terribly bad guy. Why is it so complicated?
I guess it's partly because the Constitution guarantees that you're not going to be deprived of life or liberty or without due process of law. And the Obama administration decided that due process in this case was essentially a bunch of folks inside the executive branch going over secret intelligence that they believed proved that Anwar al-Awlaki was a threat to the United States, and that was adequate. Some scholars accept that view.
We should mention that what perhaps distinguishes al-Awlaki from some of these other folks is that al-Awlaki was an American citizen.
An American citizen. Yeah. So that we're talking about U.S. Constitutional rights. Others believe that, you know, due process really means judicial due process. It means, you know, you get to face your accusers in a court of law. You get to be judged. Your innocence and guilt gets to be judged by a jury of your peers and so on. That is certainly the traditional concept of what's necessary before the government orders the execution of an American citizen. So that remains highly controversial.
And he was the first American citizen to be killed in such a manner.
Right? Yeah, actually, he was not the first American citizen to be killed, but the first one to be deliberately killed.
Yeah,
what happened in a couple of cases before that was there were Americans. There have always been a handful of American citizens who've been part of al-Qaeda in Pakistan or in Yemen. And so in some cases, they took a shot at a bunch of people they believed to be associated with al-Qaeda, and one of them turned out to be an American.
Let's give a little background to Mr. al-Awlaki. He's born in the United States. His parents were in the U.S. They're from Yemen. His parents were studying. His father was studying at university. He's born there and then lives here until he's seven, moves back to Yemen until he's 19. Pick it up from when he goes to college in Colorado at the age of 19.
So his father, Nasser al-Awlaki, had actually, after his American education, become a very prominent guy in Yemen. He was agriculture minister, chancellor of a university. So he sends his oldest son, Anwar, back to the States for an engineering education with the idea that he'll kind of become a technocrat and move back to Yemen, help out this impoverished country. And what happens is somewhat different from what his father plans. Fascinating story from Anwar's freshman year at Colorado State. His roommate at the time, a Saudi guy named Ghassan Khan, told me about how he went home to Saudi Arabia for the holidays, but Anwar stayed on campus in Colorado State. You know, you can kind of picture that. Winter in Colorado, a little bit bleak, a little bit abandoned campus. Anyway, he fell under the influence of some older sort of puritanical graduate students. And by the time his roommate got back, Anwar had been sort of, converted into this puritanical scold. For first semester, he'd been drinking and chasing girls and having a good time. And now all of a sudden, he was against all kinds of things, including TV. And his roommate told me about how he actually picked up the TV and smashed it on the ground. He also, though, on a sort of more serious note, I think he moderated some of that sort of callow puritanism of his initial exposure to this sort of brand of Islam. But he subsequently discovered a real knack for preaching in college, because at Colorado State, I went out to the campus, and for many years there's been a mosque sort of in a house at the edge of campus. They don't have a professional imam, so professors and students take turns giving Friday prayers, leading Friday prayers. And Anwar found that he was very good at this and began getting sort of more interest in the history of Islam, the history of religion.
Scott Shane's latest book is called Objective Troy, A Terrorist, A President, and the Rise of the Drone. On 88.1, it's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. So he abandons engineering, goes into being a full-time imam. He has a mosque in San Diego. He ends up in Washington at one of the largest mosques in the United States. The 9/11 attacks occur, and he is elevated in the media as the voice of moderation. He wrote personal emails to his brother that you have in the book that says, you know, this is a terrible idea, this is a bad thing. By the time of this, early 2000s, he's already achieved a fair amount of notoriety. He leaves the United States about 11 years later, but it has nothing to do with terrorism. He leaves for completely different reasons that were really kind of shocking when you heard about it.
Yes. It's not 11 years later. It's he leaves some months after 9/11, about 6 months. And so
in
about
2002,
six,
yes.
Yeah, okay. March of 2002. Mm-hmm. So in March of 2002, there were some very heavy-handed federal raids on Islamic institutions in Northern Virginia. And they were kind of mainstream institutions. It was supposedly a terrorist financing investigation, but nothing much came of it. And it angered a lot of people in that community because they felt they were, you know, loyal Americans and shouldn't be treated this way. And Anwar al-Awlaki, as the imam at this big mosque in Falls Church, Virginia, right outside D.C., gave a sermon, which you can still find like just about everything he ever said on YouTube, in which he was quite clearly furious and sort of channeling the anger of the community there about these raids. A few days after giving that sermon, Anwar al-Awlaki boards a plane for the U.K. and only comes back one more time to the United States in his life. And it's been sort of assumed that he left because he just couldn't stand that kind of wave of hostility to Muslims in the wake of 9/11. But once again, his younger brother sort of made it clear to me that that was not the case, because it happened to be that his brother was visiting him at that time. And he had asked Anwar, when are you coming back to Yemen? Because he kind of wanted him to come back and help the country. He looked up to his brother. And Anwar said, you know what, things are going great here. I have no intention of leaving. I plan to spend my career here, spend my life here. Then a few days later, he disappears. It turns out that what had happened in the interim is the manager of an escort service that Anwar al-Awlaki had been using to set up dates with prostitutes called him and said the FBI had visited, and it was quite clear that the FBI had a big file on Anwar al-Awlaki's visits to prostitutes. What had happened was the FBI was a bit worried about al-Awlaki because he had had two of the hijackers, the 9/11 hijackers, in his mosque in San Diego. And they wanted to check out, was, you know, what did this mean? Was there any connection between al-Awlaki and the plot? So they started following him around after 9/11. They could find no evidence whatsoever that he was a terrorist or that he had links to al-Qaeda. But they did discover that he was regularly visiting prostitutes. He was a preacher before a very conservative congregation. He had, denounced the kind of, sex in the media on TV and movies and so on, and given sermons about marriage and, the sanctity of marriage. So this was a kind of horrible thing for him to discover, that the FBI could expose him at any time, ruin his career, ruin his family life. And that was, it turns out, what sent him on the road.
Yeah, so he's Jim and Tammy Faye Baker all in one.
It's, very familiar story, but in the sort of Islamic context.
You talk a lot about President Obama's evolution on drone use, the difference between how he campaigned for the presidency in 2007 and 2008, and then once he became president. You write that Obama himself and his team had actually become radicalized by the threat of violence, you know, from what a lot of people call radical Islam, although the president refuses to use that terminology. So just as Anwar al-Awlaki had gotten essentially radicalized at some point in his life, the president was radicalized, in your view, in terms of his willingness to use drone strikes.
Yeah, I think a lot of people were surprised at Obama's embrace of the drone of targeted killing. And that was sort of natural because he had campaigned against what he saw as the excesses of the Bush counterterrorism programs, in particular torture, secret prisons overseas, the prison at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. And so there was sort of an assumption that he'd take a different approach. Bush had escalated drone strikes in Pakistan the last 6 months of his presidency. And, you know, that was somewhat controversial at the time. And there was a sort of assumption, I think, among liberals that Obama might scale that back. Instead, he went the other direction. And what I found was that if you look carefully at what Obama was saying, and he was quite constrained as a senator running for president because the drone program was technically classified, and so he would never use the word drone. He'd never talk explicitly about it. But what it turned out that what he was really against was the big wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, which he felt had killed a lot of civilians, generated a lot of hostility to the United States, and in terms of American security against terrorism, had very equivocal results. No one could really say that invading Afghanistan, let alone invading Iraq, had really made the U.S. safer from terrorism. So Obama was actually very attracted to the drone as a technology, as a weapon. He often told aides, let's kill the people who are trying to kill us, by which he meant, you know, the war in Iraq had cost hundreds of thousands of civilian lives by some counts. And the drone was this pinpoint weapon that could knock out two or three or five terrorists without killing a large number of civilians. So in a way, for a president who kind of wanted to focus on the domestic issues, healthcare and so on, and who was trying to pull out of the big wars, the drone seemed like the right tool to deal with the terrorist threat.
Well, there is so much to think about in this very provocative book. Unfortunately, we're out of time to think about it right now, but particularly the notion that people like Awlaki might actually be more detrimental and more dangerous to the United States in death than they were in life. Thank you so much. Good to see you.
Thanks, Tom. Thanks very much for having me.
Scott Shane, his new book is called Objective Troy, A Terrorist, A President, and the Rise of the Drone. Scott will be discussing the book tonight at the Enoch Pratt Library. It's part of the library's Writers Live series. You can meet him in the Poe Room at the Pratt tonight at 6:30. We've got information about the book as well as a link to the conversation that Scott had with Dan Rodericks on Midday a couple of weeks ago. That's all on our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning.
On Mondays, we check in with theater critic Jaewyn Rusick. She's been to the Everyman Theater to see the opening show of its 25th season, An Inspector Calls.
Designer Timothy R. McAbee's set for An Inspector Calls is so inviting, you'll wish you were a guest in this elegant dining room. But then you notice that some things about this dining room are a bit off. In Everyman Theater's smart, stylish production, the room sits on a platform, disconnected from its surroundings. And the fleur-de-lis designs on the wallpaper are oddly oversized and covered in thick plexiglass. The action, set in 1912, begins normally enough in this British play by J.B. Priestley. The Burlings, an upper-middle-class Yorkshire family, are celebrating daughter Sheila's engagement to aristocratic Gerald Croft. They couldn't be happier. Then the doorbell rings. A police inspector arrives. He wants to question them about the suicide of a young working-class woman. Are they implicated? Are we all implicated? Sophie Hinderberger and Chris Gennebach are top-notch as Sheila and the inspector. Hinderberger's Sheila starts out naive and sheltered, but she understands where this is leading well before anyone else. And Gennebach's gruff inspector is spot on as he moves from folksy to frightening. With his socio-political biases and grasp of psychology, this inspector makes Sheila's industrialist father and fiancé increasingly uneasy. Bruce Randolph Nelson portrays Sheila's father as a social-climbing windbag, and Jameson Foreman plays her fiancé as a gentleman accustomed to being deferred to. Both take umbrage at the inspector's manner and inferences.
But if you're easy with me, I'm easy with you.
After all, you know, we're respectable citizens, not dangerous criminals.
Sometimes there isn't as much difference as you think.
The production is directed by Baltimore native Noah Himmelstein in an impressive everyman debut. Himmelstein tosses in a few clues that the inspector's inquiries may not be what they seem. As the determined detective questions each person, the lights lower and music is heard. Instead of a glaring interrogation lamp, there's an otherworldly feel. London's Royal National Theatre produced a high-profile, high-concept revival of An Inspector Calls in 1992. It referenced not only 1912, when the play takes place, but also the war-torn 1940s, when the play was written, and the political climate in 1990s England, when it was revived. Director Himmelstein and his designers incorporate some minor mystical touches into the play. Their overall approach, however, is fairly conventional. With fewer flourishes, the play's didacticism has nowhere to hide, and a scenic effect at the end, similar to one in the original staging of Cabaret, overstates the play's pertinence to modern audiences. But heavy-handed though the play's message about social responsibility may be, it is still pertinent. And, with the exception of that final overstated effect, everyman's slick production smooths over the script's clunky moralizing. You'll walk away relieved not to have been the Burlings' dinner guest, but you'll be glad to have spent a few hours observing this polished take on a vintage play, a skillful launch for Everyman's 25th anniversary season.
Theater critic J. Wynn Russick. An Inspector Calls runs through October 11th at the Everyman Theater. We've got more information on our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. I'm Sheila Cast.
If you have thoughts on that segment you just heard, email us at mdmorning@wypr.org or find us on Twitter. We're at Maryland Morning. Now back to the show.
Goodness gracious, how audacious, what deception you disclose. On the dollar, on the floor, at the Vithra Countess toes.
What confusion, this delusion will destroy her, goodness knows. It's affecting good, it's acting, you're preparing to propose.
Hey, good morning again, everybody. Tom Hall with you here on Maryland Morning. You know, in the theater, some names are inextricably linked. Rodgers and Hammerstein, Lerner and Lowe, Gilbert and Sullivan. We turn now to a show at the Spotlighters Theater that gives us a glimpse of Gilbert before Sullivan became his creative partner. The librettist W.S. Gilbert wrote a musical called A Sensation Novel nearly a year before he began penning his magnum opus of iconic musicals with Arthur Sullivan. As far as anyone can tell, it's never been performed in the United States until now. The Audrey Herman Spotlighters Theater is presenting A Sensation Novel in a new edition created by my guest this morning, who has also directed this production. Michael Blum joins me today in Studio A. Good morning, Mike.
Good morning, Tom.
It's nice to see you. So give us a rundown of just what this show is about. about? What's a sensation novel?
A sensation novel is what we would call a romance fiction or an adventure fiction. It's very much still with us in summer reading books and the things you find in airport bookstores.
So these are the bodice ripper?
The bodice ripper, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And they feature extreme dramatic situations, rescues of the heroine from perilous fates worse than death, wonderful heroes who, of course, all get married to each other at the end. And this was very common. It was the major Victorian fictional form. Dickens, Trollope, Thackeray, Wilkie Collins, and many, many other writers flourished writing sensation novels, and they created many of the tropes that modern authors have used ever since. Gilbert, of course, who liked to satirize what was popular, took the overwhelming popularity of these and burlesqued them in this work, in which he turns it upside down. He takes a typical sensation novel and imagines that the characters in the novel come to life commenting on the ridiculous situations, overly dramatic and, of course, stock that they've been put into, and decide that things would be a lot better off if real life would interpose and govern what they do. So they eventually rebel against their author and against his will, force him to change the novel. And it's really very interesting. So what you get is reenactment of some of the hysterical scenes from the novel, which are quite over the top, and the characters themselves do it knowing they're over the top and commenting on it. And then you get to know these characters not as stock characters, stock cardboard creations, but as real flesh and blood people that I think by the end of this work you really get to like.
Mm-hmm. And in 1871, what form did this take, and what sort of source material did you have to do the edition of the piece that you've done now?
Gilbert wrote this as one of his works for German Reed's Gallery of Illustration. They called it a Gallery of Illustration because the theater was not some place that respectable people could go. So,
and German Reed was an actor and an impresario.
His name was Thomas German Reed, actor, impresario, composer, performer, comedian, piano entertainer, sort of a Victor Borge of all kinds of talents. He had put together a small company, and they did what they called illustrations, but they were actually musical plays. So you could take your family to an illustration, and you weren't going to the Wicked Theater.
Ah, I see. So a little semantics there.
A little semantic. And Gilbert wrote, he began with some very outlandish, and he ended up using his own real great interest in what we would call topsy-turvy, and taking situations and turning them upside down and showing people in situations they aren't used to. Now, the trouble with doing it now is that almost all Victorian literature of this period is in rags and tatters at best. In this case, of the six works that Gilbert wrote for the German Reeds, only one survives more or less complete, and that's not this one. Mm-hmm. This one, almost all the music is lost. The actual script is also in rags and tatters because it was never published in a definitive edition. There are some lines where even editors and scholars aren't sure exactly what the line was supposed to be. So in putting it together, I fell in love with this piece when becoming familiar with it decades ago. Putting it together, one has to make a decision as to what line is which, how the drama flows, and what to do about the music. As it turns out, there are four songs from the original production that survived, and there is a modern British composer named Mike Nash who wrote a beautiful series of songs recreating sort of the Gilbert style from the period.
Mm-hmm. And we have a clip from the show that the production that you're doing of a sensation novel. This is one of the pieces by German Reed. It's a duet. A catchy title, With Rage Infuriate I Burn.
Yes, in which the demure, shy little governess pulls a knife on the wicked, pantherish Rocalda and demands she turn over all her jewelry.
There you go.
And it's the highlight of the show. It's in the middle of that show.
And that's one of only four songs that survived, so Mr. Nash had to write the rest of the songs.
Wrote the rest of them. And they overlapped a little bit because when he wrote his version, which was 15 years ago, he wasn't aware of three of the surviving songs. So he ended up with doubles of several of them, which we worked everything into the show. Mm-hmm. Erica Rome and I, Erica is a brilliant accompanist, musical director, musician, and we worked all the music that we had. And I don't want to make light of that because Gilbert wrote this as an old-fashioned melodrama, by which I mean he indicated where in the musical scenes he wanted full musical underscoring. Mm-hmm. This is something that doesn't happen very much in Gilbert and Sullivan, but it happens all the time in this.
So speaking of Gilbert and Sullivan, why did it end up being Gilbert and Sullivan and not Gilbert and Reed?
It was accidental. Reed had a terrible injury about a year after this and retired from the stage. Gilbert and Sullivan were both the leaders of their respective professions, and there were many attempts to put them together. The first one that actually succeeded, as you said, Tom, was in December of 1871, which was an extravaganza named Thespis, which was put together for the Gaiety Theater by Hollingshead, John Hollingshead, the famous producer. And that was a Christmas entertainment, and it was medium successful. And it was only Doilycart who years after, in 1875, was able to put together something that lasted. So I think, similar to Rodgers and Hammerstein, Rodgers wrote with Hart until Hart became unusable. And just like Gilbert wrote with many other people until he linked up with Sullivan. And their relationship, as everybody knows, was wonderful but frayed way through.
And of course, it just shows yet again the role of serendipity in some of the great art of our time.
Absolutely so.
All right. Well, Mike Blum, thanks so much for coming in this morning and break a leg with the rest of the run.
Yes, we have six more performances, the 25th, 26th, and 27th of September, and October 2nd, 3rd, and 4th.
We will have stuff on our website that gives all the details about that. Michael Blum is the director and driving force behind the Audrey Herman Spotlighters Theater production of a sensation novel. It's there for the next two weekends until October 4th, as Mike said. We've got link to details on our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. That's it for us today. Coming up Wednesday morning, a new film examines a community school that might serve as a model for a new way to provide a range of social services in economically depressed areas. Amy Scott joins me to talk about her new film, Oiler. That's Wednesday morning right here on Maryland Morning. On 88.1, I'm Tom Hall. Thanks so much for joining us. Have a great day.
Maryland Morning is an original production
of your public radio,
WYPR,
in Baltimore.
The show is produced by Johnny McCone.
We have production help from
Christy Forrest
and Scott Seiss.
Nathan Sterner directs and engineers.
I'm Tom Hall.
And I'm Sheila Cast. On this day in Maryland history, 1965, Assateague Island became Assateague Island National Seashore by federal law signed by President Lyndon Johnson. During the previous decade, there had been plans to develop the island as a private resort. 5,000 lots were zoned and sold. But the Ash Wednesday storm of 1962 wreaked such destruction, development was scrapped. So Assateague has just spent the weekend celebrating its 50th birthday as a national seashore, and today you can still get in on free entrance. We're back on Wednesday. Please join us.